This is The Guardian.
Today, scandals, U-turns, and how the Conservative Party got mired in allegations of sleaze. When the Labour leader Keir Starmer stood up yesterday in the emergency Commons debate into the conduct of the government, he didn't pull any punches.
Last week, the Prime Minister damaged himself. And despite the bravery of some members opposite, he damaged his party. But most importantly, he damaged our democracy.
The issue, when it came down to it, was whether people could put their trust in Boris Johnson.
When the Prime Minister gives the green light to corruption, he corrodes that trust.
Tory MP Owen Paterson may have resigned last week after being found in breach of lobbying rules, while the government rode back on a plan that might have let him off. But opposition MPs were not going to let the matter rest there.
When I was first elected to this House, the mother of all parliaments, I was incredibly proud because I thought that members conducted themselves with honour and integrity.
It is hard to be proud to be a Member of Parliament when as a body we are all tarnished with the government's brush. When in the eyes of the public we are tainted by allegations of sleaze.
The Prime Minister himself, though, was nowhere to be found.
There's a debate today. Unfortunately, I can't be there because I have a long-standing engagement up here. You know, I don't think there's much more to be said about that particular case. I really don't. But what we do need to do...
But the story is far from over. There is anger with Johnson, not just among the opposition, but on his own backbenches. Some of his usual supporters in the press have been highly critical, and a poll yesterday showed his popularity had plummeted to its lowest point since becoming Prime Minister. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, are the allegations of sleaze finally catching up with the Conservatives? Jonathan Friedland, you're a political columnist for The Guardian and you've seen some parliamentary skullduggery in your time, I'm sure. But have you ever seen anything like what happened last week?
Well, you always hesitate to say something's completely unprecedented because then somebody finds an example from 1550. But this did feel really unusual. And I think the reason it felt so unusual was it didn't just relate to one individual and the accusation against him, but rather the entire government lining up behind that individual, saying he should be let off the hook. And if he has been found in violation of the rules, well, guess what? We want an entirely different rule book. That is not normally how these things work out. Normally what happens is there's somebody does something and the head of the party, the head of the government, tries to say this is one bad apple.
So this whole mess began after the All-Party Parliamentary Standards Committee recommended a 30-day suspension for the Tory MP Owen Paterson for what it called egregious breaches of the rules on lobbying for two companies that paid him £100,000 a year on top of his MP salary. Now, for anyone a bit hazy on the details, what did Paterson's allies do and how did Boris Johnson respond?
It's good you've used the phrase Paterson's allies, because that's a really big part of this story. I spoke to one minister last week who talked about the Brexit gang. Paterson, you know, may not be a household name, but he was a big figure for a long time in what was first called Euroscepticism and then became the Vote Leave campaign. You'll notice all the names in this drama tend to be from that camp. You know, Jacob Rees-Mogg, big leaver, leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom, former leader of the House, and of course at the apex, Boris Johnson himself. The story is that Standards Committee said we found him guilty of these egregious breaches. And as you say, the allies began rallying around. And there was this campaign initially, I think, conducted via Tory WhatsApp groups, which is how this business is done these days, saying we can't let this happen. Owen is a good egg. He's one of ours. And particularly, and I think this actually goes beyond just the Tory WhatsApp groups, this is across Parliament, there was a great deal of sympathy for him because of the suicide of his wife, Rose Paterson. And so there was an effort to say, on the one hand, let's get him off this hook. Can we find a way to do that? And let's also, while we're at it, devise an entire change to the standards setup.
Today, Mr. Speaker, is a day for serious consideration by all colleagues across this House. We must address the grave concerns about the way in which we are held to account under our own standing orders.
So Andrew led some formally to the House, big lever, put tables in amendment.
It is not about whether Mr. Owen Paterson is innocent or guilty under that report. It's not about letting anyone off.
Not some sort of unilateral freelance operation. Instead, she was put up to this by the chief whip himself, Mark Spencer. And that's important because it goes to this point that the lead for this was coming from the very top. And proof of that came when number 10 signaled to Tory MPs, this isn't just some vote of conscience, as it normally is on these standards decisions. No, this is going to be whipped with full party discipline. You have to, if you're a member of the government, even at the most junior level, you have to vote to let Paterson off the hook and to ditch the current standard system that's been in place for nearly three decades.
I want to read the result. The ayes to the right, 250. The noes to the left, 232.
And there was some resistance. A lot of Tory MPs, I think, thought this is not a good look. But nevertheless, the Downing Street held absolutely firm. And on Wednesday night, there was that vote and the motion was carried.
The ayes have it. The ayes have it a lot.
Shame!
So at what point does Boris Johnson realise he's got problems? And then what does he do?
I think it became really clear within minutes of the decision happening, the usual alarms that go off that alert Conservatives. And that is, first of all, social media plays a part. They suddenly start seeing people absolutely in fury about it.
My late mother used to vote Conservative all of her life.
Yep.
But she wouldn't be doing it if she was still alive today.
They will have WhatsApp groups with their own local parties. They'll have word from their agent and from constituency officials.
I'd like to say, James, is that it's an absolute farce that they think they can behave like this, and it's not wrong. I'm scared to think that what they do, if you think that this is okay, where did they cross the line? What is wrong in their opinion?
Crucially, the first editions of the newspapers, and they came later that Wednesday night, and they were excoriating. The Daily Mail and others were talking using the language of sleaze. That's a vital indicator, particularly in Downing Street, and particularly with Boris Johnson, former journalist himself. He still, it may be 2021 and the digital era, but the newspapers, the Tory newspapers, the front pages really matter. And it was, you could tell it was cutting through. There are just those signature issues which do resonate, and this very rapidly, it was clear, was one of them.
I think that the vote yesterday was all about trying to get a right of appeal. And we've been discussing this for years. It's quite wrong to say that this only came out of the blue yesterday.
It seems astonishing that no one among the Prime Minister's advisers, I mean, even as you say, the Prime Minister himself is a former journalist, the fact that he didn't have any instinct for this.
The question to you is, you say that you've been thinking about doing this for years and it's a just about process. It's a bit odd, isn't it, that the first time you think of doing anything about it is when a former cabinet colleague, the former boss of the Prime Minister's wife, is found guilty of the most egregious breach of the rules that we have seen in years. This is the moment you choose.
And then the next day, after they defend it, the government completely backtrack on their plans and Paterson ends up resigning.
Some more breaking news just in the last couple of moments, and that is that Owen Paterson, he has decided to stand down.
Now, it's worth saying here that he has always denied wrongdoing, and he says that his representations of those companies was in the public interest. But despite that, how did the Tories not see this backlash coming?
Well, it does make you wonder, and again, Tories themselves are talking about the Downing Street operation, and there's big criticism of that. That there aren't people there who have sufficiently sharp political antennae. But also the absence in today's Downing Street of people who are strong enough to say, Prime Minister, this is a really bad idea. Dominic Cummings, hate figure though he is for many on the Tory benches, he did have that ability and strength to be able to say to Boris Johnson, no, don't do this. But I do think also there is a syndrome of large majority-itis here, because a majority of 80 means you can ride it out. And the biggest of all the usual early warning systems is the House of Commons itself, your own MPs. And when, you know, in the Theresa May period, where she had almost no majority, well, no majority, you had your ear to the ground if you were Downing Street because you needed to know what would get through. They don't need to have that day to day. Well, they've learned the hard way that they do need to listen, because even with that large majority, opinion can turn very sharply.
Jonathan, this mess involving the Parliamentary Standards Committee was bad enough, but it isn't the only allegation of sleaze that Boris Johnson is facing this week, is it?
No, and I think this is partly why the whole business was damaging, because there is a pattern. And of course, that's the message Labour have gone for very quickly, that there is a pattern here. It was rumbling that, for example, Peter Cruddas, big donor to the Conservative Party, former treasurer, was awarded a peerage, even though the Lords Appointments Commission had said they did not think he was fit to receive a peerage. Boris Johnson again trampled right over the rules and said, I'm going to ignore your warning and I'm going to appoint him anyway. I think 16 of the past former treasurers of the Conservative Party have been megabucks donors, and pretty well all of them have been rewarded with a peerage. Peerage is in the air as well, because a lot of agitation over the claims or whispers that Owen Paterson would himself be offered or had been offered a peerage. That's been denied by Downing Street. The bigger backdrop to all of this is, and this has been rumbling since the beginning of the pandemic, is this notion of preferment in procurement, that there was a high priority lane, for so-called VIP lane, fast-tracked, for those who had contacts with ministers. If you're in a minister's contacts book, you got to the head of the queue in terms of those very lucrative PPE contracts and also test and trace. The government own estimate is £2.8 billion of public money was spent on products and services that didn't work, that were defective, only because they were in that high priority VIP lane.
At this point, it's fair to say that Tory spokespersons deny any link between donations to the party and peerages. But is there any significance in the fact that this whole thing that started this off was an attempt to rip up the disciplinary process in Parliament? I mean, there are some MPs openly wondering if this was about Owen Paterson at all.
Yes. The question is it the case that, as some of Boris Johnson's defenders say, that his great weakness is that he's just too loyal a friend and he was trying to stand by Owen Paterson and do him a favour, particularly moved by the terrible personal circumstances that Owen Paterson has found himself in? Or was actually Owen Paterson merely the pretext for something that Boris Johnson wanted to do anyway? And that was to hobble the Standards Committee and rewrite their rules. Why would Boris Johnson want to do that? Because he himself is in that committee's sights and the Standards Commissioner's sights over, first of all, his receipt of that free holiday in Mustique, funded by a friend and by someone else, and whether or not he declared it properly.
The Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards is investigating who paid for a holiday in a luxury villa in Mustique, enjoyed by Boris Johnson and his partner, Carrie Symons. Downing Street said the Prime Minister had abided by the rules and had transparently declared the benefit in kind received.
Second, because of the saga of the Prime Minister's wallpaper.
But his decision to make it his own, with a reportedly £200,000 refurbishment, has raised questions over who paid for it and whether he received help from an undeclared Tory donor.
The big redecoration of Downing Street, again, not paid for out of his pocket. Did he declare it properly? Did he only pay up when he was caught? And there is a slew of questions and investigations by the standards apparatus that makes Boris Johnson actually the most investigated of all members of Parliament. How convenient that the committee and the whole apparatus is gutted and replaced by a pliant body who will, on the nod, exonerate Boris Johnson for all those claims.
I think it's difficult to see what the future of the commissioner is, given the fact that we're reviewing the process and we're overturning and trying to reform.
You got an insight into what the government, or perhaps Boris Johnson himself, wanted to happen in that excruciating round of interviews the business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, did in the immediate sort of 12, 24-hour period, where he said that the Standards Commissioner, Catherine Stone, would now, in effect, want to consider her position.
Process, but it's up to the Commissioner to decide her position.
So you think she should resign?
All I've said is that we're trying to reform the process, and I think that's what I'm very focused on.
I mean, it was almost like saying the quiet part out loud, that he was putting the squeeze on the Standards Commissioner, saying, there's the door, because that's what they obviously wanted.
Well, it depends on your definition of corruptness. I mean, if you mean necessarily...
Jonathan, on Saturday morning, the former Prime Minister, John Major, intervened to call Boris Johnson's government politically corrupt. Now, he's no fan of Johnson, but that's quite an attack from a usually mild-mannered man, isn't it?
It really was ferocious, and your point about him being mild-mannered is why it was so powerful. Because John Major doesn't do that often, and he doesn't turn the dial up to 11.
I think the way the government handled that was shameful and wrong and unworthy of this or indeed any government.
And there he was being absolutely ferocious in his denunciation. And you could tell he had decided what he was going to say and was determined to say it. He went for this broader point that there was a pattern of behaviour there and using the language of political corruption.
Good evening. Conservative Party activists in the Cheshire constituency of Tatton are meeting now to decide the fate of Neil Hamilton, their former MP, who's been dogged by, but always denied, allegations that he took cash to ask questions in Parliament.
And he's someone who knows a government mired in sleaze when he sees one. Are you seeing parallels to the 1990s when every week seemed to bring a new tabloid sting or government sleaze story?
Well, I wrote something really early on in this government saying normally it takes, 15 years for a Tory government to get swamped in sleaze, and he's managed to do it in 6 months. But I now think that sleaze is far too mild a word for what this government is doing. The sleaze that was around in the 1990s was about those specific individuals, and in each case, John Major at the top was then desperately trying to, show strength and crack down on and discipline, and he would never attempt to defend those who were accused. He went out of his way to set up the standard system that we now have. The reverse is true this time. It isn't just a handful of backbenchers or even, in the Jonathan Aitken case, one government minister. It is rather the problem is from the very top, and that's what makes this much more serious than the sleaze in the 1990s.
I have made it clear from the very outset that these matters must be properly examined. Why else would I have set up the inquiries? Many people criticised me for doing so and said, why have you done this? You could have brushed it aside after a week of parliamentary difficulty and it would all have gone away. I didn't do that.
I think the scale is different, because a lot of the sleaze stories, not Neil Hamilton, not Jonathan Aitken, but they were about personal, often sexual, private life behaviour. Whereas what's going on now is people taking money from private companies, big money, acting as their paid advocates without ever revealing it. Here, this has been going on for years, and Boris Johnson effectively said nothing wrong with that.
Well, as you say, it's from the top down. And in your most recent column on Saturday, you've suggested that we don't even need to go that far back to the past for other political parallels. And you've hinted that the comparisons are stronger with Hungary's Viktor Orban. Is that not a bit extreme?
Well, I know it sounds extreme. And so when I wrote this, I sort of said, I know we don't use the word and we don't use it because we feel it's hyperbolic. But this is how authoritarianism looks. We have a notion in our mind that authoritarians are, strutting dictators making speeches on balconies in old black and white newsreels. Actually, what the word means, one of the things that defines authoritarianism, is an attempt to concentrate all power in the centre and to remove all checks or restraints on that power and to shut down, yes, political pluralism in the form of opposition, but also just those institutions which might check or challenge the government. And you look at what he's doing. Boris Johnson wants to reform, in quotes, but really weaken the Electoral Commission, the referee for elections. He's got this attack on the power of judicial review by the courts. In other words, the ability of the courts to mark the government's homework. He wants to change that. You look at other institutions that hold the government in check, including, for example, the BBC. We don't think it can be us because if people are speaking English and are in London, it can't possibly be the same. But actually, that is the pattern. This has been clear with Boris Johnson from the start, and it became really apparent last week. That is a move straight out of the textbook authoritarian to say, one of my mates has been found guilty. I'm going to dissolve the court that found him guilty and change the law. Not on in a democracy.
In no other profession in our country could someone be found guilty by an independent process and just have their mates vote them back into the job.
Well, Jonathan, one thing we can say about the last few days is that the government isn't able to act with impunity. The opposition and independent media was ultimately able to force a U-turn. We've heard all day the fury of opposition MPs. Are they going to be able to keep this level of pressure on the government up? And what tools do they have to do that?
I may not be quite as optimistic as you are, Nosheen, about this, because I'm not sure the government can't act with impunity, because it wasn't really the opposition and the, your very sort of appropriate phrase about independent media, it wasn't them who forced this U-turn on Boris Johnson. It was because his own side wasn't having it in the form of the Tory press and dissent on those backbenches. If the Tory camp itself is fully on board, then they really can act with impunity. And so far they have been able to. You know, so when Robert Jenrick fast-tracked planning decision to Tory donor Richard Desmond, Jenrick stayed in his job. Priti Patel breaking the ministerial code over that bullying case, Boris Johnson kept her in the job. She's still there. So I'm not sure really how much power the opposition do have with this, except to just keep the issue on the news. And one big weapon they have in this battle is Keir Starmer himself, because he's got many limitations, Keir Starmer, but the idea of being the forensic sleaze-busting prosecutor, that's right in his patch.
Who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's...
As the former head of the Crown Prosecution Service, he can play that sort of Elliot Ness sleazebuster role with conviction. And whatever else people say about Keir Starmer, they do believe he is sort of clean personally and hasn't got scandals of his own of this kind.
Either the taxpayer paid the initial invoice, or it was the Conservative Party, or it was a private donor, or it was the Prime Minister. So I'm making it easy for the Prime Minister. It's now multiple choice.
And therefore, that's a real strength. Labour can really use him to go again and again and again after the notion that this is a corrupt government and they have John Major's words at their fingertips. So I think this is a good issue for Labour. It's a particularly good issue for Keir Starmer, but they shouldn't kid themselves that if the Tories unite and want to do it, they can still do it.
Coming up, how much damage are the allegations of sleaze doing to the Conservative Party? There is now going to be a lot of scrutiny on MPs' additional jobs. This is something that has been long controversial. We published a list yesterday on The Guardian of 30 MPs, 28 of whom were Tories, with pretty well-paid consultancy roles. And we heard yesterday in Parliament that opposition MPs want reform in the area. What are the chances of that now?
The politics of this are fascinating because MPs are very happy to talk quite high-mindedly about the principles of being their duty to their constituents and so on. But this gets them where it hurts, in their wallets. I mean, you have revealed by The Guardian that the likes of Andrew Mitchell, you know, is pocketing £182,000 on top of his MP salary from six different outside jobs, including, you know, a couple of banks and so on. Another Tory, Julian Smith, £144,000 from three extra jobs. Now, the reason why this matters is if those people are suddenly seeing that not just the exposure of this, which is uncomfortable, but the possible abolition of the right to have a second job, that is going to be really tough for those people, especially those people who have no prospect of ministerial advancement. That group of former ministers in particular, they know they're not going to get back in again. They once had a very nice hefty ministerial salary, which they've lost. And one of the things that sort of keeps them happy is that they can still earn money on the side. If Boris Johnson is forced by public pressure to make that impossible for Conservative MPs, he's going to have a very interesting political problem, because he's going to have a lot of very unhappy MPs on his own benches who will blame him for, you know, cocking this up for them losing that earning power. And they will say, if you had just told Paterson to take his 30-day suspension, no one would have even noticed this thing. It's because you tried to change the rules, perhaps to save your own skin, that we are now impoverished, as they would see it, forced to live on a measly £82,000 Member of Parliament salary, and we've lost that right. So that is storing up a real party management problem for Boris Johnson. And as I've said, that's where the trouble is for him.
We say that and we understand that about Boris, but the one thing he is really good at is defying political gravity. I mean, he cheers people up, they forgive him his excesses, because in election after election, voters do still seem to like him and they just seem to expect this behaviour of him. You hear often in those vox pops, oh, it's Boris being Boris. Is there any sign that that is now changing?
What I would say is this. All of this stuff is building up and it will be there, lodged in the public mind. And, you know, they always say, that how do companies go bankrupt? You know, very, very slowly and then very, very fast. And that's what I think this will be like. It's very gradual. A picture is forming and then something will happen. And it, you know, who knows? It could even be this, but it or might be something much further down the line. And when it does happen very rapidly, all of the previous episodes will be brought back to the fore and people will wash their hands of Boris Johnson. And I think that, you know, that moment is coming. We just, you know, it could be 2 months away. It could be 10 years away. But there is a record now.
How much damage do you think he's done to his standing within the Tory party itself?
Oh, I think he's done some because there's anger that he was made, as one Tory minister put it to me, made us all look like idiots. The idea of voting for something and then reversing it. You know, the likes of Kwasi Kwarteng will be furious that they were sent out to defend something that then changed a few hours later. There's fury at Downing Street and the operation there, that how do they not have the antennae to realise this? There's just less respect. They will be less willing to take Downing Street's lead next time. So just in terms of the actual political practice, as political operators, they are diminished in the eyes of their own party. But also, the deal that the Conservative Party in Parliament made with Boris Johnson is, we've chose you as our leader not because we like you, a lot of them don't like him, but because you are a winner who has this very adept touch with the public. And if he is seen to be losing that touch, you know, not having the political instincts to realise this was an absolutely disastrously stupid thing to do, then he begins to look different in their eyes.
We shouldn't also lose sight of the fact that there's some incredibly tough conditions for the government in the coming months. COVID hasn't gone away. There is a cost of living squeeze getting even tougher for families. Supply chains are at breaking point. How dangerous a moment is this for Johnson's premiership?
Well, if it was a normal government, I think you'd be saying it's really perilous. If it is a really tough winter COVID-wise and runaway inflation making groceries and you know, petrol and everything much more expensive, this normally would be perilous, but he has always managed to avoid that. And I think it's partly a reflection that the country does not seem ready to see Labour as a governing party. It's got out of the habit of seeing Labour as an alternative government. So he's got away with it. But at some point, political gravity, to use your phrase from earlier, will be restored. There are some very early signs of some erosion in the Tories' position and in his own personal ratings as Prime Minister. They're early days. You wouldn't want to you know, bet the house on that yet. But that is in the minds of those Conservative MPs, and it's even more sharply in their minds after the events of the last few days.
Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. My thanks to Jonathan Friedland, and credit to the Guardian's investigations team, which first exposed Owen Paterson's lobbying on behalf of two companies back in 2019, and they provided evidence to the Parliamentary Standards Commission to begin their own investigation. Do keep up with all the rest of the comings and goings of Parliament with our politics team at theguardian.com. And don't forget to check in on our sister podcast, Science Weekly, which is now daily, at the COP26, bringing you all the developments from the most important climate summit on Earth. And finally, a correction to a line in one of last week's episodes of Today in Focus. in which we said that the majority of people dying of COVID in the UK were unvaccinated. This was true earlier this year, but with the increased spread of the virus in recent weeks, the latest UK data shows that, in fact, most COVID deaths are now among people who have had the vaccine. We should add, of course, this does not mean that the vaccines are not effective, just that they are not 100% effective, and that with such a high proportion of the UK population now vaccinated, there sadly will be COVID deaths among them. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.